All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a closer look at a case that really shook things up in property law, especially here in Massachusetts. We're talking about Eaton v. Federal National Mortgage Association, or FNMA for short. This one's a bit of a landmark decision that kind of redefined how foreclosures work, particularly when it comes to the connection between mortgages and the all-important promissory notes behind them.
Yeah, that's spot on. If any of you out there listening are law students, especially those of you wrestling with secured transactions or getting deep into the weeds of real estate law, Eaton isn't just another case to gloss over. It's one of those foundational cases that really shows you how courts go about interpreting statutes, how they lean on common law principles, and how they wrestle with the very real consequences of their rulings. It really forces you to think about the practical implications of legal principles that might seem kind of abstract at first glance.
So let's break down the big question at the heart of Eaton. Essentially, it boils down to this. Can you legally forfirm on a property if you have the mortgage, but not the actual promissory note, you know, that crucial IOU? And to really grasp why the answer from the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, the SJC, is so important for your studies, we need to dive into the nitty-gritty of the case itself.
Okay, so let's paint a picture of what happened. It all started back in 2007. Henrietta Eaton, she's in Boston, decided to refinance her home. Pretty standard stuff, right? So as part of this whole process, she signed two key documents. The first was a promissory note with Bank United for $145,000. This, of course, was her promise to repay the loan. And then the second document she signed was a mortgage. Now here's where things get a little interesting. Instead of the mortgage being made directly to Bank United, it was made out to Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, Inc., better known as MERS, who were acting as a nominee for Bank United.
Oh, MERS. You're going to see that name pop up a lot in real estate law. Think of MERS as a sort of central electronic registry that keeps tabs on mortgage interests as these loans get bought and sold in the secondary market. So instead of recording a ton of assignments every time a loan changes hands, the initial mortgage often names MERS as the mortgagee. It's all about streamlining things on the back end. Now, the kicker here is that the mortgage in Eaton's case also included something called a power of sale clause.
Right, and that power of sale clause, that's really crucial for you to understand. What it does is it essentially gives the mortgagee the right, under certain conditions, like if the borrower defaults on the loan, to sell the property. They can do this without having to go through a full-blown court process. It's a much faster way for lenders to get their money back compared to going through a formal judicial foreclosure.
So let's fast forward a couple of years to 2009. Things took a bit of a turn when MERS, acting on behalf of Bank United, assigned the mortgage to Green Tree Servicing, LLC. And by this time, unfortunately, Miss Eaton had defaulted on her loan payments. So Green Tree, armed with that power of sale provision in the mortgage, decided to kick off foreclosure proceedings. They even ended up being the highest bidder at the foreclosure sale, which happened in November of 2009.
And then to keep this chain of events going, Green Tree turned around and assigned their winning bid at the foreclosure sale to Fannie Mae, the Federal National Mortgage Association. That's where the FNMA and the case name comes from, by the way. So Fannie Mae recorded the foreclosure deed, essentially making them the official owners of the property. And in January 2010, they started the process of trying to evict Miss Eaton.
But this is where Eaton fought back, and her argument is really the crux of the Eaton decision, the one you really need to understand. She argued that the whole foreclosure process was basically invalid right from the get-go because Green Tree, the company that started the foreclosure and held the sale, they didn't actually have the promissory note, that initial promise to repay the $145,000.
Exactly. What Eaton was saying was that without that note, Green Tree didn't have the legal right, the standing, to even start those foreclosure proceedings. So she filed a counterclaim in court and asked for something called a preliminary injunction. That's basically a court order to put the eviction process on hold while these key legal questions got sorted out.
And the first court, the Superior Court, actually sided with Eaton on this. They granted the preliminary injunction because they thought she had a good chance of winning her argument that the foreclosure wasn't valid because Green Tree didn't have that promissory note. This initial ruling basically set the stage for the really big legal question that eventually went up to the SJC for a final decision.
So the core legal issue here, the one that's at the very heart of Eaton, and something you really have to understand, is this. Under Massachusetts law, can someone foreclose on a property using a power of sale if they have the mortgage, but not the promissory note that goes with it? That's the question the SJC had to answer.
Okay, so what did the SJC say? How did they sort through this pretty complex issue with all its potential consequences?
Well, the SJC based their decision on a very well-established common law principle, the mortgage follows the note. To put it simply, the mortgage is basically the security for the debt, and the promissory note is the actual evidence of that debt. It's the borrower's promise in writing to repay the loan. The whole point of a mortgage is to give the lender a way to get their money back by claiming the property as collateral if the borrower doesn't pay up.
That makes total sense. It's like the mortgage is the tool you use to enforce the promise made in the note. You can't really use the tool if you don't have the promise it's meant to enforce.
Precisely. And because of this, the SJC went on to say that separating the mortgage from the underlying debt basically makes the mortgage a mere technical interest. If you don't have the obligation of the note, the mortgage is just a piece of paper attached to the property title, but it's missing that crucial element it's supposed to secure. This isn't just some old legal saying. It's a core principle of how secured debt works. The mortgage, which is the security interest, is meaningless without the actual obligation it's supposed to secure. So Eaton kind of reaffirmed this basic principle, especially in the context of how things work today, with loans getting bundled and separated from the original notes.
So how did the SJC apply this common law principle to the specific laws in Massachusetts that govern foreclosures?
They took a close look at two specific laws, General Laws Chapter 183, Section 21, and Chapter 244, Section 14. These laws spell out who qualifies as a mortgage. That's the person or entity who has the right to start foreclosure proceedings. What the SJC said was that in this context, a mortgage has to have both the mortgage and the promissory note. Or, and this is important for this case, they have to be acting as the authorized agent of whoever holds the note.
So just having the mortgage document itself isn't enough to foreclose in Massachusetts?
Not according to the FJC in Eaton. They said that while you don't always need to physically have the note in your hand, like if you can prove you're acting on behalf of whoever holds the note with their permission in this particular case, Greentree didn't show any evidence that they were acting as Bank United's agent or the agent of anyone else who might have had the note. They only had the mortgage.
This sounds like a ruling that could have had some pretty big consequences. Did this suddenly invalidate a whole bunch of foreclosures that had already happened in Massachusetts?
That's where the SJC made a really practical decision, showing how courts often have to balance things carefully. They realized that if their ruling was applied retroactively, meaning to all the foreclosures that had already happened, it would cause a lot of chaos. People would be questioning who really owned properties, and it would create a lot of uncertainty about property titles. So they said their interpretation would only apply going forward. That means it would only affect foreclosures where the notice of sale was given after their decision was issued. This wasn't just about preventing chaos. It was also the court recognizing that the financial industry had been operating under a certain understanding, even if it turned out to be legally flawed.
That makes a lot of sense. Imagine the legal mess if suddenly every foreclosure in Massachusetts where the foreclosing party only had the mortgage was declared invalid. It would have been total chaos in the housing market.
Exactly. The SJC's decision to apply the ruling only to future cases shows that they were thinking about the real-world impact of their decision, not just the legal theory. They didn't want to disrupt property rights and the economy more than necessary.
So because of this analysis, the SJC basically created a two-part test that anyone who wants to foreclose in Massachusetts has to meet.
Yep, that's right. The Eaton decision established a clear two-part test. First, you have to have a valid mortgage on the property. Second, you have to either have the promissory note yourself or be able to prove that you're acting on behalf of the person or company who does have the note.
And how did this two-part test affect companies like MERS, who we talked about earlier, that often hold the mortgage but not the actual note?
Well, this ruling had a big impact on how MERS operates in Massachusetts foreclosures. Just being named as the mortgagee on the original mortgage document isn't enough anymore. Under the Eaton standard, MERS or any company that got the mortgage from them has to show that they either have the note or that they're acting with the note holder's permission. Otherwise, they can't foreclose. This ruling forced MERS to rethink how they handle things, especially since their whole purpose was to make it easier to track mortgages as they were bought and sold.
It sounds like this ruling also helps to prevent some of those bad practices that were going on during the foreclosure crisis, things like robo-signing where documents were being signed without really checking who actually held the debt.
Oh, absolutely. By emphasizing the connection to the promissory note, the Eaton decision made things a lot more transparent. It helps to ensure that only the people or companies who have a real financial interest in the debt can start a foreclosure. It's not enough to just say you're acting on behalf of the note holder anymore. You have to have proof.
So what were the biggest practical implications of Eaton for real estate and mortgage law in Massachusetts?
For lenders and loan servicers in Massachusetts, Eaton basically meant they had to completely change how they handled foreclosures. They couldn't just rely on having the mortgage anymore. They needed to keep track of the promissory note and be able to prove their connection to it, either through ownership or a formal agreement with the note holder. This made things a bit more complicated for them, but it also made the process more transparent and protected borrowers more.
And as we said before, the fact that the SJC decided to apply the ruling only to future cases was really important to prevent people from challenging who owned properties and causing a lot of instability in the housing market.
Exactly. And for you law students out there, Eaton is a great example of how court decisions don't just happen in a vacuum. Courts have to think about the legal principles, of course, but they also have to consider the practical effects their decisions will have on people, the economy, and the legal system as a whole.
There's a really memorable quote from the SJC's opinion in Eaton that I think really sums up their reasoning.
You're thinking of this one, right? The court said, "A mortgage separated from the underlying debt is a mere technical interest." That one sentence really captures the core idea behind their decision. It goes back to that fundamental principle that a mortgage is meaningless without the debt it's supposed to secure.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, what would you say is the key takeaway from our discussion of Eaton v. FNMA?
The most important thing for you law students to remember is that in Massachusetts, if you want to foreclose on a property, you absolutely have to be able to show that you have a legal right to the debt. You can't just rely on having the mortgage document. You either need to have the promissory note or you need to prove that you're acting on behalf of whoever does have it.
This really highlights how important it is to understand the difference between a mortgage and a promissory note. They might seem like two parts of the same thing, but legally they're separate documents with their own rules and consequences.
Definitely. And this case raises some other interesting questions to think about. How might these same principles apply to other situations where debt is secured by property? And what does agency really mean in today's financial world, where things are so complex? These are things you'll want to keep in mind as you continue your legal studies.
Lots to think about there. We've covered a lot of ground today. Thanks for joining me for this deep dive into Eaton.
It's been a pleasure.
And thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.